Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
All right, should we do this?
Yeah, let's do it.
Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, here with ProPublica's Dara Lind and with Vox's Ella Nilsson. She joined Jane and I right before the election to talk about the Senate races that were in play. Those races wound up going, I would say, considerably less well for Democrats than they had hoped or anticipated based on the polls. But we're now left with a situation in which there are 50 Senate seats held by Republicans, 48 held by Democrats and their New England independent allies, and two races outstanding in the state of Georgia. So we're gonna talk about that. What's at stake here seems pretty high to me. I mean, if you 50-50 Senate, Kamala Harris breaks the tie. And on the most basic level, that means that, like, normal Joe Biden appointees will just get confirmed. There might be somebody Joe Manchin has a problem with, but, like, you would just expect that a well-qualified nominee without a scandal will be confirmed. Whereas Mitch McConnell hasn't really, you know, he hasn't, like, broken out his cocaine Mitch or Grim Reaper memes yet. But if you have a 52-48 Senate, it's, like, really not clear to me, like, how the government is going to function at all.
Right. Like, Joe Biden's agenda and any hope for some sort of bold agenda from Democrats is, I mean, even with a 50-50 Senate, is not looking great, because it's a caucus with Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and other very moderate members. But yeah, I mean, given how the last few years of McConnell as Senate Majority Leader have gone, there's, like, no, like, real hope, I feel like, in the future for cabinet appointees to sail through smoothly.
You know, I'm struck by a contrast between how progressives and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, address these kinds of things, right? So in the waning weeks of the 2020 campaign, every place, like, including the Weeds podcast, Vox.com, every progressive site I read, every progressive Twitter feed, was full of very explicit statements about, like, if we win this thing, like, we're making new states, we're ending the filibuster, maybe we'll pack the court. Like, there was this very high profile debate about the sort of extreme procedural measures, like the hardball tactics the Democrats would unleash. I don't see that.
Most of which were, and, like, that's not, and this is not irrelevant here, focused on correcting the geographic bias of the United States Senate.
Yes, yes. Whereas, like, I don't see, I mean, I can't say that I read every conservative article or every conservative Twitter feed, but, like, I don't see people saying, oh, if Loeffler and Perdue win, we're going to block all of Biden's cabinet nominees. We're going to make sure that zero judges are confirmed, right? And it's interesting, because people will say on the left is, like, well, you know, like, how can you discipline people? But, like, I think it would be really bad for Perdue and Loeffler if the normal person's understanding of this election was that if Republicans win, we will have a rolling constitutional crisis. And if Democrats win, there will be very tepid legislation. but it's not out there like that. Like they are all they're doing this weird thing about the vote count and the fraud, but like they're not saying the plan is to win these races and then make sure that like there is no EPA. But I think that's what's at stake here.
It would not be surprising to me if those conversations aren't happening explicitly. I mean, I think the question facing Senate Republicans, if they do get the majority, and this is to a certain extent putting the cart before the horse, even to discuss this before we actually talk about the races, but like there is a certain question of, do you attempt to pick your battles not for like, you know, not because you have any desire to be conciliatory toward Joe Biden, but just because in a world where you go nuclear on all cabinet appointees, the Biden administration is more likely to say, well, we'll take the same approach to the Federal Vacancies Reform Act that the Trump administration did and just like ignore it to a large extent and we'll appoint whomever we want? Or like, do you play enough ball that they're actually going to take your opinions into consideration in appointing people? Matt, I'm sure that your answer to that would be that the people who Joe Biden is going to want to appoint to cabinet positions are likely to be fairly moderate anyway. But it's not clear that Senate Republicans themselves would agree with that at this point, right? It does appear that a lot of Republican elected officials genuinely do believe that the Biden administration is going to be run by radical leftists. And so there would be, you know, there would be a certain consideration there. I think that that's kind of illustrative of a bigger problem that would happen, which is that the Biden administration is already going to be torn between a characterological desire to go high and play by the rules and be statesmanlike, and the reality that it is going to be harder for them to get things done if they do not play hardball. And dealing with a Republican Senate majority might actually push them to be more aggressive on the hardball stuff earlier in an administration if it becomes clear that there is absolutely no way that they're going to be able to work with Congress.
Well, I would just point out like a couple of things on that front. First of all, I saw like an Axios report a couple weeks ago that was sort of like Mitch McConnell's, you know, Republican-led Senate might be the death knell for progressives' hope of, you know, getting a number of progressive folks in Biden's cabinet. And my first thought was, well, maybe that's kind of that Joe Biden doesn't really care about that. Because it's like people he would want in his cabinet anyway are the, you know, the more moderate folks. So I don't know about that. But then the other thing, too, is like, we have to see how this dynamic shakes out, because certainly, you know, McConnell with Obama as president just, you know, stonewalled everything. But McConnell and Biden do have sort of like this longer personal relationship and working relationship from their many years spent in the Senate together. You know, Biden obviously made a huge part of his pitch as president to sort of go back to these days of bipartisan work in the Senate, even though there is an open question if that Senate still exists. But I do think it's too early yet to see how McConnell and Biden work together themselves to know exactly what McConnell's tactics are going to be.
But I guess I would encourage people to think of a distinction between different kinds of jobs, right? So, you know, everybody thinks Biden will appoint Michelle Flournoy to be defense secretary. And Republicans don't have a big problem with Michelle Flournoy. She's a relatively moderate Democrat. Also, Republicans want the military to exist. Like, they believe in that. In a lot of ways, Biden and McConnell are probably closer on national security, military affairs issues than Trump and McConnell were. So that's like no problem. She'll sail through. Treasury, I think the leading contender was probably Lil Brainard all along. People on the left have some problems with her. Again, like Mitch McConnell doesn't want the stock market to crash and like corporate America to be wailing. So a moderate Treasury secretary, fine. And Biden is probably even happy to tell people on the left, like, oh, I would have loved to put Liz Warren up, but I just couldn't, right? Because like, would he have loved to? Probably not. But then you have like the EPA, you have the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, you have the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. You have all these agencies that Republicans are not going to mind if they just sort of don't exist. Like, if the work of rebuilding the demoralized staff of an agency with a traditional progressive mission that was kneecapped by the Trump administration just like doesn't get done because you don't have a confirmed secretary, like That's fine for Mitch McConnell. And back in 2015, or even before that, right, what part of what drove Harry Reid to eliminate filibusters for confirmations is that Senate Republicans said that they wouldn't confirm anybody to run the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. They wouldn't confirm any judges to the D.C. Circuit. And I feel like those kind of tactics are going to come back, except this time there won't be like a hardball workaround necessarily. And then again, like if conservatives played this game the way progressives do, like they wouldn't be able to stop themselves from talking about this. And like we'd be on CNN all the time with like the talking heads being like, should Mitch McConnell just stonewall all appointees at regulatory agencies so that we have no protection against pollution? And we're like not doing, I don't know. I'm impressed by their ability to kind of like hide the ball on this and frame the campaign around, you know, like Raphael Warnock and the radical left rather than is there a functioning government?
I don't know. I think that this is just another case of everyone's the victim of their own story and that it's not that surprising that people are more concerned about the consequences of an election if their side loses than they are thinking about the consequences if their side wins. Like, I think it's really only in the last weeks of the presidential campaign when progressives and Democrats even started to accept that it was more likely than not that Joe Biden would win and that any kind of measuring the drapes conversation about ending the filibuster and all that kind of thing was the Democratic equivalent of irrational exuberance.
Well, actually, let me ask Asghella, what's the situation in Georgia? Why are we having these having these runoffs at all? Like what's going on?
Yeah. So right now we have a doubleheader for Senate runoffs in Georgia. And as we have sort of been teeing this up here, it is, you know, Democrats' absolute last hope to potentially flip the Senate after a few of the races that I think, you know, Democratic operatives thought would be easier to win, like Maine and North Carolina, did not pan out. So, I mean, Georgia's really interesting here. Biden won it very narrowly on the presidential level. I think, you know, Georgia, you could argue that Georgia and Arizona were probably the two states in Sunbelt areas that flipped for the first time in decades at the presidential level. It's, you know, been a long time coming with demographic change and things like that. But certainly there's an argument to be made that suburbs in both states and folks, especially white college educated suburbanites who just didn't like Trump, combined with a more diverse electorate, predominantly black voters in Georgia and predominantly Latino voters in Arizona, kind of created this perfect storm to flip at the presidential level. So the question now remains, and I don't think anybody is going to know for sure until January 5th, is that trend going to continue for Senate candidates? Georgia runoffs in the past, Democrats have had a very bad track record. I think the last Senate one was 2008, where the Democratic candidate lost pretty badly. And basically, you know, I think that the biggest question here is, I mean, the biggest question is turnout, obviously, and presidential. It's almost certainly not going to be as high as it was, you know, for Biden and Trump driving their respective bases and other swing voters in the presidential. But the question is, you know, which side can get more of their voters to turn out for a runoff election? And I think the other big question, especially for Democrats, is do these white suburbanites who, you know, one operative called Romney Republicans, you know, former moderate Republicans who like low taxes but don't like Trump, who might have voted for Biden in the presidential, do they continue to stick it to the GOP and vote in Ossoff and Warnock, or do they decide that they're fine with Perdue and Loeffler and don't want to hand, you know, Democrats unified control of Congress and the White House? And, you know, I sort of think that the second option is the more likely scenario. But there are a lot of really interesting dynamics wrapped up in these races. And it's a fascinating time.
So it seems like your assessment of the race is going to depend on why you think Georgia went blue in 2020 to begin with, right? In the presidential election.
Yeah.
And I'd love to hear you kind of talk through what your reporting has led you to believe on this, because, it, you know, in 2016, Georgia was seen as a gettable state for Democrats, maybe not in 2016, but certainly in like future cycles because of this, like, we're going to mobilize the base strategy. Stacey Abrams really came to prominence even before her gubernatorial run, encouraging Democrats to invest in expanding voter registration, expanding mobilization to like historically underserved communities in the hopes of creating a, you know, progressive electoral majority that didn't require them to be backtacking to white moderates all the time. And now it seems to a certain extent, like given what you're saying about these Romney Republicans, that there's an argument to be made that when Georgia actually did vote for a Democrat for president, it was because of the exact same white moderate voters that the Stacey Abrams strategy was supposed to do an end run around needing in the Democratic coalition, which obviously has very different stakes for this runoff and also for, you know, Democrats' future electoral strategy and coalition building. So how do you kind of reconcile those two things?
Yeah, I mean, folks that I have been talking to say, like, obviously, you need both, right? Like, you need a fired up base of Black voters and voters of color. And you also need these sort of swing white moderates. And especially, I think I would argue that this trend in the suburbs is being driven by predominantly women. There are men, too, but this is just something that we've seen as a continuation. So there are a couple of different things. I mean, on the Stacey Abrams strategy, like, that certainly can't be underestimated. And Stacey Abrams and other groups driven by particularly like women of color and Black women, you know, doing the work to register folks and make voting easier for people. There's also, you know, Georgia has automatic voter registration through the DMV, which is something that was passed in 2016. And that also can't be underestimated for, you know, a vehicle to register more folks and get more folks able to vote. There's also, I mean, just Metro Atlanta is just a fascinating part of this story. It's a place that has been, you know, growing very fast. I think I was looking at some stats. It's home to 6 million people as of 2019. 734,000 people moved there from 2010 to 2019. There are a lot of Fortune 500 companies. It's just like a desirable place to move to and live. And so that, you know, that can't be separated from the story of like why Georgia is blueing and why it's getting more favorable for Democrats. But yeah, I mean, I think that it's interesting. I mean, a lot of folks have sort of talked about Ossoff's 2017 congressional race and that special election as kind of being one of the first things that mobilized white suburban women in particular, and certainly, you know, Black voters as well. But I think that this was post-Trump. I mean, certainly like the Trump fatigue hadn't set in as much, but it kind of spurred this backlash among white suburbanites who didn't like, you know, just didn't like Trump's, you know, racism, sexism, things that he would say about women. And I think that, you know, people that I've talked to said that really kind of became the central kind of way that people expressed their frustration with Trump early on. And it was kind of, you know, even though Ossoff ultimately lost that race, it was kind of an early sign of things to come, and really kind of became a way for people to get organized early on.
So Nate Cohn at the New York Times was able to do a sort of detailed look at the Georgia electorate this morning. It's one of the first states that we have this complete data for. And it's a little bit of a nuanced story because like you can get it wrong, but it's like Black turnout went up in Georgia. So the strategy to mobilize Black voters succeeded, but white turnout went up by more. So the Black share of the electorate declined a little from where it was in 2018. It was lower than it was in 2016, 2014, you know, and in sort of any recent election. So you wouldn't say the reason Biden won was that Black voters were mobilized, because they were actually less mobilized than white voters. But then you can flip it again and you can say, well, if raw Black turnout had stayed where it had been, then the Black share of the electorate would have dropped even more and Biden would have lost. So it was mobilizing Black voters, you know, which is just to say, like, you can sort of peel this onion of like what caused what in many, many, many different ways. But at least like at a high level, we did not see a relative surge in Black turnout in Georgia. We saw, you know, what Ella was saying, which is that seemingly white people, although the suburbs of Atlanta are fairly diverse, but it seems like white suburbanites who had previously been solidly Republican kind of had this break. And that's why I was emphasizing the sort of interpretive stakes, right? Because if you think about this election as, well, if Perdue and Loeffler win, we're going to have divided government and bipartisanship, versus if Ossoff and Warnock win, we're going to have the progressive agenda unleashed. To me, that suggests to like a Romney-Biden switcher, I should vote Republican. Whereas if you see the stakes here as being, if the Democrats win, we're going to have a functioning government, but any legislation is going to have to be substantially bipartisan, versus if Republicans win, we're going to have sort of ongoing constitutional crisis. Like, that's a much more compelling argument to a kind of swing electorate. And I think it's more accurate. Like, it doesn't seem to me that a 50-50 Democratic Senate is going to, like, uncork a ton of ambitious bills. But it's also hard. I feel like that's a tough... We should take a break and talk about this. But, like, it's hard for me to imagine, like, John Ossoff running an ad talking about how little he's going to get done in a 50-50 Senate, but he will be able to stave off total crisis. Like, it's a difficult needle to thread. So let's take a break.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
So, Ella, who are these guys? Ossoff, as you mentioned, was one of the earliest characters in the Trump politics show, Here for a Comeback. And who is Raphael Warnock? Like, what is going on? How did these two guys come to be the hinge point of American politics?
Yeah, so Raphael Warnock is the senior pastor at the Ebenezer Baptist Church, which is a storied church in Atlanta. Martin Luther King Jr. Was a pastor there back in the 60s. And so it has this very, you know, storied history of civil rights in the South. Warnock is an interesting character. I mean, he is now, you know, obviously Jamie Harrison in South Carolina did not win his race. So, you know, he is the lone Black candidate that still has a chance to make it into the Senate. It's interesting. Like, I was talking to somebody a couple days ago who basically said that Warnock's favorability ratings are, or in polls, he has the highest favorability thus far. And that could basically be sort of a symptom of Kelly Loeffler basically having to run against fellow Republican Doug Collins in the special election thus far. She had a pretty, you know, serious primary challenge from the right. Loeffler herself was appointed by Republican Governor Brian Kemp to sort of appeal to this suburban white woman cohort that we have been talking about. But during her race with Collins, she kind of took this abrupt hard right turn because Collins obviously is one of, you know, he's a Trump loyalist in the House. And so Loeffler got an endorsement from Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is the congresswoman from Georgia, who, you know, espouses QAnon beliefs. She put out this ad saying that she was more conservative than Attila the Hun. There was a lot of stuff going on. Republicans are trying to basically define Warnock as you know, a radical, essentially. There have been a lot of ads with Jeremiah Wright and, you know, a lot of things saying that Warnock is radical. They've been trying to, you know, they've been painting John Ossoff as a socialist. I feel like all of the ads that I get from Purdue's press team are just socialist John Ossoff. So I think that, you know, at a basic level, Warnock and Ossoff are making the argument that if they are elected, Democrats in the Senate can pass, you know, some more COVID relief, more economic relief, lower prescription drug prices, bring down the cost of healthcare. It's sort of these very common sense things. Ossoff, in particular, has been talking a lot about anti-corruption bills because Purdue and Loeffler are both very wealthy and both have had some interesting stock trades in the past. But yeah, it's like, you know, this kind of pragmatic Democratic agenda versus socialism, essentially, coming from the Republicans.
Something that I kind of want to get at that I think is kind of implicit in this, but should be made more explicit is, like, obviously, Georgia's runoff system is, like, unusual among states, right? Like, the fact that, you know, Loeffler and Warnock are in a runoff because Loeffler primarily had to run against another Republican in November is, like, not a thing that, you know, that's not the way most states work. And it means that Democrats arguably have a better chance than they otherwise would have, at least in that race, arguably in the other race as well, because they were able to deal with a plurality system rather than having to get a majority on first cut. But, like, the runoff system also results in people having to show up for two different elections just to get their preferred candidate in, which, Matt, is something you've talked about a lot, is, like, one of the low-key ways that the United States makes it very difficult for people to exercise their, like, Democratic interests, because there are all of these different elections for all of these different races. And, you know, obviously Georgia is one of the many states in the union that has something of a history of making changes to the electoral system to make it harder for Black people to vote. So, you know, I think that that's something that needs to kind of be addressed here. But I also kind of wonder, given, Matt, what you were saying about white turnout having increased in 2020 over 2016, and some of the kind of emerging conventional wisdom that people were even more mobilized for Donald Trump in 2020 than they were in 2016. Ella, do you think we're talking about a situation where, you know, you can generally assume that the Democratic base is less likely to turn out for, like, non-presidential elections, and therefore it's likely to be a more Republican composition of the electorate? Or do you think that both sides actually are going to struggle a little bit to get people to the polls for something where the president isn't on the ballot?
Yeah, I think that this is a really interesting question, particularly where we are at right now with Georgia's presidential election results and the fact that Trump lost them. So, in any other year, you know, you might assume that even if the incumbent president had lost, that he, you know, would go down there and campaign for Republicans and, you know, try to kind of have this message of we still need to hold the Senate, et cetera, et cetera. But Trump is still refusing to concede the presidential election and seems very obsessed with his own numbers in Georgia. So much so that there is now a massive feud between Trump loyalists and the very Republican and very conservative Georgia Secretary of State, who gave a kind of incredible interview to The Washington Post last night and, was just like, I don't know what these people like. I don't know. Like, we're doing everything legally. Like, we're recounting the votes. Like, I don't know what these people want me to do. And so there is this really interesting. That's why it's hard to assume anything in these runoffs. And it's tough to kind of go by past runoffs to tell us, exactly what would happen. Because you're right. The conventional wisdom is that, there might be slightly more Republican voters in Georgia and they might be, Republicans might be better at mobilizing their base on low turnout elections. That's what we've seen in the past. But the fact is that there is serious infighting happening between Trump loyalists and other Republicans in, Georgia officials. It's kind of shocking to me that, Governor Kemp is like enemy number one of Trump aficionados right now. And so, yeah, it's very unclear whether Trump is going to come down in campaign or like try to get members of his own base in rural Georgia areas to turn out for Perdue and Loeffler. And it's unclear if, Trump's name being on the ballot in 2020 spurred really high Republican turnout. But as we've seen, like in the 2018 midterms, his name not being on the ballot ended up being worse for Republicans, at least in House races. So it's really unclear, like exactly how all of that is going to impact things. And there is, I am a big believer in Donald Trump's pettiness. There is one constant in this world. It's that, if Trump is upset about something impacting him personally, I don't know if he is going to sort of let greater Republican political strategy supersede that,
You can really imagine, I don't know, like Michelle Obama, who doesn't really like this stuff, making some phone calls to help Ossoff try to keep African American voters engaged in the runoff, something like that. Because I don't know, it's very clearly like she doesn't love this like party obligation kind of stuff, but like she does it. Donald Trump, like, he really doesn't care about whether or not Mitch McConnell is able to block Biden's circuit court appointees. Like, as much as he bragged about his circuit court appointees, it's like, it's very clear that he doesn't actually care about the future of the judiciary. This was just part of his cockamamie thing. And to some extent, it could be really bad for Republicans in just a turnout psychology kind of way. If one of the most visible people in the party is not engaged at all with the race, while Democrats are all like sincerely trying to win.
I mean, there's also, of course, the fact that like it's not just that he's not engaged with the race, but that he is actively engaged in sending the message that the state of Georgia cannot be trusted to run a reliable election, which seems also bad for turnout psychology, arguably.
Right. There's even the fact that like Collins probably would not be that sad to see Loeffler lose. They don't seem to love each other in a really serious way. Traditionally that kind of infighting hurts, right? I mean, you look at the 2008 Georgia Senate race. I remember this one, and it was like technically Democrats had a shot to win it. But the reason it went to a runoff was that the Libertarian candidate got some outlandishly high share of the vote. It was like around 10%. So the Republican was like just under 50, and the Democrat was way below 50%. And Democrats didn't really know how to approach it strategically because like they had 58 Senate seats at that point. They were still doing a recount in Minnesota. Obama had just won this big landslide. It didn't seem like Georgia voters were all that into the Democratic candidate. And like throwing national party resources into the race to be like, hey guys, you need to like super empower our agenda. Like that seemed like it was going to backfire. So turnout crashed. They lost really, really badly. I'm sure you could have handled it better, but like I was working at the Center for American Progress at that time. And I mean, I remember people sitting around being like, what can we do about Georgia? And like, we couldn't figure it out. There didn't seem to be a good answer. Whereas now, like, Georgia voted for Biden. So like trying to get as many people as possible involved to say like, this is really important. Joe Biden really wants you to vote for John Ossoff. Biden really wants to confirm his people. Like, Biden wants to pass his COVID relief bill. It might not work, but it's obvious like what you want to do. Whereas the Republicans are, I don't know, at odds, I guess would be the polite way to say it.
Ella, as an actual Hill reporter, I would love to know, like, how are Senate Republicans talking about this? Like, not obviously like the Georgia Republicans being kind of one subset of this, but also, you know, what are Republicans who are currently in the Senate, like, how are they thinking about the kind of upside of getting more seats versus the difficulty of appearing to run afoul of the president right now?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of feel like it's just kind of like, let Trump do his thing. And I mean, this is why, like, you know, everything that we've just been speculating about here about how Trump is going to impact, you know, ultimately Republican turnout, while I think is a very valid question, like, Republicans do have very clear messaging here, which is basically, you know, if they lose the Senate, you know, they have no, you know, they have less of a say in the legislation that goes forward. And so it is certainly, you know, like I said, you know, Purdue and folks are labeling these candidates as socialists. But that, I feel like that is also kind of the national Republican messaging, is like, a Republican Senate is the only thing that stands between the U.S. and socialism, which obviously is not true. But yeah, that is that I Republicans have their eye, you know, on the ball, and they have Senate Republicans have a clear message. But the question is, what is the extent that Trump mucks that message up, basically?
Is there any concern that by like not throwing all of their efforts toward mobilizing people to turn out for this January 5th runoff, or even by like talking so much about the idea that the presidential election in Georgia was rigged, that they are doing any damage to Loeffler and Purdue's chances? Or like, are they assuming that they can just kind of have their cake and eat it too and question the results of the November election while encouraging people to turn out for the January one?
Yeah, I mean, I think that could be like a tough needle to thread. But yeah, ultimately, like, I think that Republican mobilization is, you know, it's still going to happen. They're not going to like encourage people to sit this one out because they're, you know, calling those election results into question. And I do think that like there is like a clear, even though Loeffler and Purdue very much need Trump's support and his base to turn out, I think that there is kind of this clear difference between, you know, folks like Lindsey Graham that are actively like calling the results into question versus like other, you know, McConnell, I feel like, hasn't really said a lot on this, but he's certainly not like stoking. He's not trying to stoke these fears, I feel like.
All right. I think let's wrap it up there. Take our second break and do our white paper.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prop G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. Not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday, and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
So this week's white paper is called Media, Pulpit, and Populist Persuasion, Evidence from Father Coughlin. It's from Tianyi Wang of the University of Pittsburgh. And the paper uses Father Coughlin was a very popular and populist radio host who, you know, was a Catholic priest, but who, especially during the 1930s, turned to social and economic commentary because of his status as like the most popular radio commentator of the day. The availability of his sermons, or like secular sermons, was broadly distributed through through a network of radio stations that had agreed to carry them. So this paper looks at the signal strength of the stations that were carrying Father Coughlin commentary, predicts which areas of the country would have been able to hear that commentary, and uses it, looks at how those areas changed in their support for FDR when Father Coughlin himself turned against FDR in the 1936 election, looks at the prevalence of anti-Semitism in those communities through whether they had chapters of the German-American Bund, whether they were supportive of war bonds during World War II, and like long-term anti-Semitic attitudes, and finds that in all of these regards, having access to, exposure to the commentary of Father Coughlin did make it more likely that people adopted these right-wing populist views that Coughlin was pushing. The extent of the effect varies. He finds that for every standard deviation of increase, likelihood that they were able to listen to Father Coughlin, that there was a like 2 or 3 percentage point shift in the vote against FDR compared to places that wouldn't have been able to listen to those, but finds it much more substantial differences in the German-American Bund and war bonds differences, which suggests pretty strongly that the attitudes towards whether it was a good idea to get involved in World War II and who, you know, whether the U.S. was on the right side of that fight were strongly, and you know, not just in how people thought of those issues, but whether they were willing to, like, donate time and money either to the war effort or to support for, you know, German-American relations in opposition to the war, were strongly influenced by this one very charismatic popular figure. It's an interesting use of data. There isn't hard radio data on, like, yes, this household could receive, you know, these radio signals. So it's an interesting way of combining these kind of predictive models of what a 50 kilowatt signal would have looked like, and some topographical analysis with a very relevant question of, you know, what are the, when a charismatic leader has the ability to directly reach his followers through a mass medium, how persistent is that in changing their views?
It's reminding me of a political scientist I know, and he was criticizing himself and his colleagues for how they do, in a more contemporary era, sort of media effect type stuff. Because he was saying it's like, it's easy to fire up LexisNexis and see what the Wall Street Journal editorials say, but it would be really annoying to do a content analysis of right-wing talk radio. So it tends to be, it's not that like people don't know that Rush Limbaugh is an important person, but it's, you know, not, it's not studied because it's hard to study. And this was an interesting one where it's sort of broad enough that, like, we generally know what this guy's show was about and how it was distinctive from other things. So you can just look at, you know, where could people get it? We often get interesting studies from these moments of technological transition. Like, there's good papers about the rollout of Fox News across the country, because now it's on every cable system. But when it was new, it wasn't. So there's like a period of several years in which you can instrument it. I mean, now I'm sure there's some pockets of the United States where you can't get Rush Limbaugh on the radio. But like the radio stations are pretty good right now. But in the 30s, the technology was janky enough that you can study in this way. What's interesting, you never know if people are just desk drawing their null effects, but it seems to me that every time we have an episode like this, the Fox News rollout, Sinclair Broadcasting's acquisition of new local radio chains, now this thing about Coughlin in the 30s, it does show that mass media is important to politics, which I feel like is both obvious, but also something that those of us who work in the mass media, I think, sometimes shy away from saying. Like, in an interesting way, like, journalists don't want to say our work doesn't matter, but like also don't want to say that our work is driving the election outcomes and that like we are personally responsible for what people do, because I think we don't think of ourselves as like political operative, you know, like we don't want the responsibility for who wins House races, but what we do, you know, it seems like it matters.
Right. I mean, it's very easy to turn this into just kind of a paralyzing observer effect, right? Like, I kind of understand why it's more convenient for us as journalists to, like, have a strategic blind spot here than to be constantly torn between our, like, ethical obligation and the reason that we got into this industry being to, like, describe what is going on and the knowledge that by describing it, we are changing it.
One of the other things that I think is like kind of a difficult question to answer, but as I was reading the paper, I was just like so struck by, I guess, just sort of the more like, I don't know if I want to say like centralized news sources, but basically just like the fact that like people would get their news from like the radio or like, you know, a newspaper or a couple of newspapers. Whereas now there's just so much to choose from, even if that, you know, you're just like limiting yourself to mass media and not like social media or like, you know, weird websites out there that people, you know, kind of can choose whatever they want. And so I like was just thinking about that last night. And again, I just like, I have no idea how you could answer that question, but I was, yeah.
Well, the particularly interesting thing about that is that, and this is something that like, I didn't know enough about Father Coughlin to know about, to know prior to reading the kind of like historical background section of this paper, but the dude's career essentially ended because the Association of Broadcasters decided to self-regulate and create a rule that was facially not about Father Coughlin, but in practice prevented radio stations from being, for like radio stations in holding themselves to that rule said to, you know, Coughlin or Coughlin Enterprises or whatever, like, sorry, we can't carry your show anymore. And the, you know, that is itself, Ella, a product of the kind of centralization you're talking about, but it's also a product, Matt, of mass media understanding that they did have a key political influence, at least in the kind of gatekeeper function of we can broadcast these views or we can choose to avoid doing so. And, you know, I think that it would be very tempting to say like, oh, this demonstrates that if you just starve people of platforms, they're not, you know, they won't have as much influence. But like, Ella, because of what you were talking about with the proliferation of media outlets, with the increased, you know, kind of direct to consumer quality of social media, it's pretty obvious that you couldn't get the equivalent of the National Association of Broadcasters to like get take a single person from being arguably the most influential media personality in America to just being persona non grata.
Yeah. I mean, and I think it's important, you know, I think if you want to understand mid 20th century American history, the fact that you had these incredibly popular broadcast platforms that had a narrow number of choke points and that they were used, right, starting in the you know, late 1930s and through to the mid 1980s, extreme opinions were strangled in broadcast media. Like, obviously, at the height of the civil rights movement, you could have had a popular television show that was about how the segregationists were correct, but like nobody had a show like that, right? But there were three networks, right? So even if it was only a third of the population agreed with that viewpoint, like there would have been a good market for it, but none of the networks put something like that on. And there was no pro-communist show, right? Like there was a mix of formal and informal rules, but like you couldn't deviate from the bipartisan Cold War consensus. And there were a lot of like problems with that. You know, you read Noam Chomsky's old books. That's the real manufacturing consent era in which you can just cover up things that the government does that are bad. But also, a lot of constructive things happened in American politics and society during that era. And today it's like, you can't do it. Like, you can't stop people from publishing Q content. Or you can. I mean, and to some extent you do, but it pops up elsewhere on the internet. There's no equivalent to being driven off the radio.
I mean, the other thing that I kind of wanted to point out is like, I was tempted initially in reading this paper to make a connection. There is some historical analysis of radio as a technological innovation and the rise of fascism, both in Europe in the 1930s and then the use of radio in the Rwandan genocide in the 1990s. And there is a consensus that, like, the centralizing power of mass media is very good for totalitarian regimes to broadcast propaganda and, you know, control public opinion. And I was initially tempted to kind of to, you know, because of the sub, because like Father Coughlin's views were not necessarily fascist, but like certainly aligned in the direction of sympathy for Europe's fascist governments, that like, oh, there is something about radio that is particularly sympathetic to this kind of viewpoint. And I don't think that that's fair. You know, on reading it, I don't think that's what's going on at all, because there's a very important difference, obviously, as we've been discussing, between like being a government propaganda outlet and being just like some dude who, if your stations decide to drop you, you're dropped. But I think that it's worth kind of pointing out that that is the downside of centralized media apparatus, isn't just the kind of manufacturing consent thing we had in America, but that it's much more vulnerable to state takeover and being used, you know, solely as propaganda rather than as an independent or enlightening media at all.
All right. Well, you can't take the weeds off the air. So we will keep bringing the truth to you. Thanks so much, Ella, for joining us. I'm sure that we will have you back soon again. Talk about what's happening in the legislature as things shape up. Thanks as always to our sponsors, our producer, Jeffrey Geld, and the Weeds will be back on Friday with a continuation of the next 4 year series.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.